There are a lot of things we have that are amazing, but we take them for granted. Have you ever seen those videos online where the person being recorded is colorblind and their family gets them these specially made sunglasses that actually allow a person to see colors even though they've never been able to before? Of course, everyone in the family wants to see their reaction the first time they put on those glasses. So they all go outside, and there are usually some brightly colored balloons nearby, and the birthday person opens up this package to find a pair of sunglasses. Nice, thanks for the sunglasses. And of course, everyone encourages them to try them on. And what happens when they put those glasses on, and they are now actually seeing colors instead of everything being black and white or just having shades of difference? Their reaction is always amazing. In many cases, they're just so overwhelmed by the colors and overcome by emotion, they start to cry because of what they're seeing. In that moment, everything has changed for them. They see everything differently, and they notice every single color. But for most of us, we walk around every day seeing all of these vibrant colors, and we never have a single thought about it. It's just our normal. We often don't understand or appreciate something until we're able to see the difference between having it and not having it. My guest today, Chris, can attest to that. Like most of us, he grew up having hands, a left hand and a right hand. They were right there with him for more than 40 years, always doing what he needed them to do. But today, the hands that Chris uses are not the hands he was born with. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a girl hanging by her broken leg from the telephone wire.
And I called 911 and I said, I found a baby.
I turned around. I see a gun pointed at me close enough I could touch it.
She would hold our heads underwater all the time.
He levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down.
Her eyes were full of tears. She didn't want to leave us.
My hair catches on fire.
I swear to God, this image is burning my head for the rest of my life.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll just get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
You've said that you had a feeling that something was not quite right that day. How long did you feel like that before the actual accident happened?
This happened on the 28th, which was a Friday, 28th of November, 2008. The day before was Thanksgiving, which I had celebrated with my family. So then on Friday, got up early, did a few things. I remember my parents were in and out, and I had mentioned that I am going to Carlisle for the day to help my friend harvest corn. And so I drove down and got there around 7:30 in the morning and had the feeling of something is not right, but I could not put my finger on it. That feeling did not last very long, maybe a few minutes or so, and then I just continued on with my routine. Routine being checking the machinery out to see if everything's intact. Everything's going to be operational. Looking for any unforeseen issues that could cause a problem.
And how old were you at this time?
I was approximately 41.
So you were taking the day after Thanksgiving just to go to help your friend harvest some corn. And for the listeners who are not familiar with corn harvesting, and I include myself among that bunch, what's the process? What kind of machinery is involved?
This machinery is a dated piece of machinery, probably built in the 50s. It's mostly all mechanical, and it connects to a power source, which would be a tractor. And the tractor has a drawbar that hooks this piece of equipment and then puts it in motion, or gets the mechanical operation, is what they call a power takeoff. And it's a drivetrain that it's driven off of the tractor's engine, but also it drives the piece of equipment. And then behind this corn picker is a wagon, which is a gravity box. Inside, it's sloped inside. Once it's full, gravity empties the wagon. So how this machine works is, you know, stalks of corn in rows. The planter actually plants them specific inches apart. It's shaped like a V in the front. In the V, there's these chains. They're called gathering chains. They've got little ears on them. So what this machine and those chains do is actually pulls the stalk into the machine. And then right below those chains is two sets of rollers. And these rollers are approximately about an inch apart, just wide enough apart for a stalk to go through it, but not allow the cob of corn to go through it. So it actually pulls the stalk of corn down through the machine, through the rollers. And once it gets to the cob, the next part is it actually will clean the husk off, because the husk is already dried out at this point. There's these rubber fingers in there that clean off the silk. Then it just goes up through an elevator that is chain driven with a rubber paddle that carries the corn up the elevator into the wagon. Throughout the day, I was walking around the machine, make sure there was no issues. Well, I was having issues with those chains that I spoke of. One of them kept falling off. And so I was talking to the farmer, and he says, why don't you just take it off and just use one? And I'm like, okay, that's a good idea. So fast forward back to around the time of the accident, going through the field. It's already dark.
Oh, so you've been working all day by now.
Oh yeah, it was all day, and it took me all day to just fill this wagon up. Around 5 o'clock, I had noticed that the wagon was starting to overflow with corn. And mind you, this was my last row of corn to be done for the year. That was, as soon as I get to the other end, I was done. Well, I stopped, left the tractor run with the PTO running, got off of the tractor, exited, walked around. I see the ear of corn laying in the V shape. Went to bat it in with my hand, my left hand. Didn't go in. Went to do it again with my left hand. And that time, the chain that was left, I don't know, it happened so quick. The chain had grabbed my cuff of my coat, pulled my hand into the rollers. And at that point, my left hand was in between those rollers, which I said was an inch apart, and they did not spread. It just stays stationary. It stays. And I can add a little bit of more detail to the rollers. The rollers actually spin at 12 linear feet per second. So if you just imagine 12-foot 2x4, it's in 1 second, it's gone through. And that's what happened to my hand. I do remember hearing a thump, and then initially pain. And then I'm like, what do I do? Quick reaction was reach with my right hand. I reached with my right. And at that point, both of my hands are now in the machine.
Can you describe what's the actual damage to your hands at this time? Are they being cut up? Are they being squeezed into a really tight place? Or what's actually happening to your hands?
Well, honestly, at that, you know, being there looking at it or thinking back now, I mean, I'll explain what you're asking, but back then I had no idea what happened. I mean, how do I get out of this? So what is happening is those rollers being only an inch apart, it's actually squeezing it. It crushed my hand. It actually, the doctors had told me later, it degloved, took the skin right off of my hand.
So you're standing now with both of your hands there in the machine.
At this point, I was not standing any longer. I was kind of hunched over when it first happened with my left. And then once I reached with my right, I was actually in a kneeling position, kind of like picturing like I'm praying over this machine. I had my head down. I'm stuck in this machine because at that point, my hands are down. I couldn't move. I couldn't pull them back. I was doing everything I can to pull out, but being in so much pain, I had a baklava on. It's like a hat, but it had an opening in my face. So every time I would turn my head to scream, it would actually cover my face. So it was muting the sound. But also, that tractor was running at 540 RPM. So that means that tractor was at high idle. This was loud. There was a state road probably 75 to 100 yards away from where I was at. I was pointing the opposite direction. So I'm actually in this machine and the road is behind my back and is behind me. I was actually going the other direction in the field to finish up. To my left was a house that was probably 50 yards. So I'm in this machine trying to do everything I can to get out. Finally, I was like, God, let me die. God, let me die. God, let me die. Well, that third time, somebody had came. But what else is relevant is that from that house that I just said at 50 yards, there's probably another house 100 yards away. The people that lived in that house that was 100 yards away came over to the house that was 50 yards away and said, I think there's something going on there. Maybe we should go check. So at that point, when I said after the three times, let me die, somebody comes, they had come. I found out later because I went to visit those people. They were saying that, yeah, I was out earlier, but I only saw the tractor in the field. The lights were on and it was running, but I didn't hear anything. So you remember I said I was screaming out in pain. Well, that screaming out was not constant. Because, you know, at this point, when I'm in this machine, I've lost a lot of blood at this point.
So how long from the time the accident happened until someone showed up?
That's a good question because I don't really know.
When you're in a situation like that, time kind of changes. You don't really.
It does. But what's interesting is that I do know a time, but it wasn't when they had come to show up, when they came to find me. It was more, I recall how long I was in this machine before I was life flighted out of the place, out of the area. Vaguely, I remember, I felt it happened around 5 o'clock and I did not get to Hershey Medical Center until 6:30. So that's how long of a window there was. I don't know how long it took for the emergency crew or the neighbor to find me, emergency crew to get me out of the machine. I do recall them seeing the situation. The one EMT was there and he was telling me, you're going to be fine. Don't look at your hand because I guess he was concerned that I would pass out. I couldn't understand why he was saying that. I mean, he really didn't know me. I mean, I grew up on a farm. I've seen a lot of things and you know, he's just basically protecting me from passing out, apparently.
Yeah, I'm thinking it must have been traumatizing, like before the EMTs showed up, just the people from the house coming over and seeing what your situation was it had to be kind of traumatizing for them as well.
Oh, I'm sure, because I remember when they came, I was like, you know, you and I are speaking in a normal tone. This was over this machinery. I was giving them phone numbers of who to call. Call my ex-wife, call my mother and dad, call. And I was even rattling off the phone numbers just through all of this while my hands are stuck in this machine. I think by that point, the machine was already off. I remember them saying to shut the fuel off. The farmer, I had rattled off his phone number. So the farmer finally came and he helped them get this machine apart.
Yeah, I got to think, and EMTs aren't trained in getting people extracted from farm machinery.
Well, in this area, especially Pennsylvania, where there's a lot of farms around, I think they do have, they're more and more, they're getting a lot more training.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I think they should be, for sure.
Yeah. It's actually, this is kind of sidebar. I was at a bingo last night with my wife, and one of the firemen was there, and I asked him, I said, are you a fireman? He said, yeah. And I said, hey, you want to see something cool? And I told him, and then he said, yeah, farm accidents are very traumatic. So I know that they're being trained, because it wasn't like, oh wow, they, you know, I think it depends on where you're located.
So when you were finally removed, you said you remained conscious. Did you look at your hands at all, or could you see that they were obviously destroyed, or what were you thinking?
Actually, only thing I recall was on my left. I remember my hand was hanging like by a thread, literally by a thread. And I think it's whenever the EMT said, no, don't look at that. I remember them saying things like, get the bird in the air. So they had where I live, it's called Lifeline. And so that's what this helicopter's called, the Lifeline. I remember being loaded on the Lifeline, and I remember them shutting the door on my right side and remembering how much pain I was in, because I think they bumped what was left of my right arm into the door, and everything's happening so fast. I just remember that moment being in pain, and then getting on the flight, and they had their flight helmets on, so they basically couldn't hear anything I was saying. With as much blood I lost and everything, they were having a very hard time, difficult time getting to my veins, because I had talked to the flight nurse later on, and he explained that whenever you're in a traumatic accident, your body will take your blood flow and take it to your vital organs, your brain, your heart. The rest of it is, it's not being supplied. And what else helped me, I think, survive is not pass out or die, that it was cold this time of the year, especially in Pennsylvania in November. So it was probably at 5 o'clock already. It was probably in the low 30s at that point.
So you were airlifted to the hospital, and was there any attempt to save your hands?
That's another good question, but I do not know. All I know is, I do recall another thing that the flight nurse says, hey, I know you're in a lot of pain. We're going to get you taken care of. Basically, give me whatever pain medication they administer. So it happened in Carlisle, and I was going to be flown to Hershey Medical Center. And by car, it's a 45-minute drive. By flight, it was 8 minutes. And during this flight, I never passed out. So we're flying, and, you know, this couple conversations went on, but nothing was, you know, I don't think they've really even heard me. I was just listening to what they had to say. Got to Hershey. We landed on helipad, and at the time they were remodeling the hospital, building a new wing on, and to get into the emergency room was a makeshift tunnel. All I recall is laying on the stretcher and looking at the lights, like watching the lights go by. And I remember a nurse coming to me. Hey, she said, Mr. Pollock, you're going to be fine. You're at the number one trauma center. And at that moment is when I passed out. That's the last I recall. So I'm sure that I passed out, because I guess I knew I was safe. I got there, I think I said around 6:30. think I was conscious again until following day, and I do not recall the time. You know, at that time, my family was all contacted. My ex-wife was there, my mother and dad, my brother, my sisters, just everybody that had some relation to me, they were there. And I remember that doctor coming in with my, I think it was with my brother, and we were in the room, and he says, the doctor said, I want to talk to you. And he said, do you know what happened? And I said, yeah, I lost both of my hands. And that's pretty much where I left it. And he explained that, yeah, you lost your right arm 4 inches below your elbow or 4 centimeters, and they were dislocated. So basically your right side was basically taken out of the socket, the elbow joint, and we had to reset them and pin them together. And we also did a skin graft. So they took a skin graft off of my left leg to wrap this area where after the amputation, because it was just basically destroyed from the machine, I guess, degloving it as well, as I mentioned earlier. On my left side, my hand was disarticulated. So it was basically taken right off of the joint. And he explained how, you know, why we had to do what we had to do. He said basically everything was crushed, debris and dirt and grease, that there was no way of saving either side. That's where I was at with that.
I read that when you learned or realized that you now no longer have hands, mm-hmm. that you decided immediately to turn the negative into a positive. Was it that quick? I mean, that seems like an impulse. Like you didn't really realize the full gravity of what had happened. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. And it's interesting you say impulse, because it was quick. Yes. I remember laying in my room where there was no one in there. It was just me. And I was saying that I am not going to take pity from anybody. I don't know how I'm going to get through this, but I am. So I was in the hospital at that point right after the amputations. And I stayed in the hospital for 2 weeks. And during that 2 weeks, they had therapists come in, you know, occupational therapists, physical therapists. There was even a recreational therapist. And it's all relevant to why they came in, because they were actually, people take these things for granted, but at that point I couldn't take it for granted anymore. You need to learn how to do activities for daily living. So now that I have no hands, how am I going to brush my teeth? How am I going to bathe myself? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? So during all that time, I trained to do all of those things. And then I also mentioned I had a recreational therapist, and I remember this recreational therapist giving me some literature on hand transplants. And they were doing, so this is 2008, they were doing hand transplants in Louisville. Louisville was the first place in the United States that was doing hand transplants. And I think the guy, first guy that had them in Louisville, had double hand transplants. And I think he had lost them by fireworks. Anyway, I read this story and it was interesting. Oh, wow, transplants. But the part that I wasn't sold on was the medication that you had to be on, where you had to go, being in Louisville for 7 or 8 months.
What was it about the medication? I saw that you had rejected the idea because of the medication, but what didn't you like about that?
It seemed to be a lot. At that time, I was on depression medicine and some others, blood pressure, cholesterol, that kind of thing. I felt like I was taking enough already, and I didn't want to take any more. So that was probably my main reason why I didn't do it at that time.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
Let's face it, money is the one subject we all need to deal with, but no one actually wants to talk about. The good news is there's a podcast helping you learn everything about money no one taught you. Meet Everyone's Talkin' Money, hosted by me, Shauna Game. Everyone's Talkin' Money focuses on relevant, inclusive, and forward-thinking conversations around money and just helps you get in a better relationship with your money no matter what your goals are. Do yourself a favor and subscribe to Everyone's Talkin' Money podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s?
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
I get discharged, then I had to be put into another facility where it was a lot more training, a lot more activities for daily living. And at that time is when I was fitted. I was fitted for prosthetics. So I had an appointment to Hershey. I remember this facility I was at. I remember seeing this guy there. He had lost one leg due to a motorcycle accident. And there was this prosthetist in there working with him. And that's the guy that makes the prosthetics. And I just thought, wow, that's fascinating. The things he's doing to get him to use an artificial leg. And I just kept that in the back of my mind. And then I'm going. So I was given a name to a hand therapist in Hershey. She actually started training me right away and fitting and getting me fitted. So on my left side, I had what they call a farmer's hook. So what it is, to picture what it looks like, is it's a shell made of fiber, sort of fiberglass and some, I don't know, other material. But at the very end is a hook mounted to it, metal. And this hook actually rotates about 270 degrees and you can flex it. There's a little button, a little spring loaded thing you push that you can flex it to either all the way to the left or all the way to the right. So you got some movement that way. And then how it operated was this hook had rubber bands around it, real heavy duty rubber bands. And the hook had a cable attached to it that ran up the length of the shell of the prosthetic. And then it was hooked to a strapping system that actually hooked on both sides of my shoulders. It was kind of like, I'm going to say it looked like a bra, but it was on your back. And so how you operated was you just flexed your shoulders. You just moved your shoulders in or out. And well, if you moved them in, it would actually open that hook and then the rubber band would actually close it. So that was the first thing I was fitted for. And I remember my right side was so damaged at the time. And then with the skin graft, it took a lot longer for the healing process. So I couldn't be fitted right away. So I would go to hand therapy, learning new activities for daily living. Even though I talked about activity daily living before, that's without my hands. Now I have a prosthetic. Had to learn how to tie my shoes all over again. And I learned how to tie my shoes with just that hook. It took me a little bit of time. I mean, of course, I don't have my right. And you know, you're constantly wanting to reach over there, even though your hand is not there. And that's where You know, I know people talk about phantom pain, phantom sensations. Well, I had phantom sensations. It was more like, oh, I can feel, like, even though my right arm wasn't there, I could feel that I have a hangnail on my right. It's just, it was kind of weird.
That's incredible. Yeah, you had that right arm for 41 years.
Yeah.
You're still going to imagine that it's there. So you were tying your shoe with just your left hand with that.
And the hook, yeah.
Hook, yeah. Prior to this, were you left-handed or right-handed?
I was right-handed for 41 years, and then this accident happened, and I did not know it at this point, but I started to learn to do things with my left, such the hook.
Yeah, you were kind of forced into it, at least at this point in the process anyway.
Yeah, and so at this point when I'm going through this, I was like, I have no other options here. What am I going to do? By then I could learn how to hold a toothbrush with my hook. The occupational therapists were the greatest because they always came up with these little things because they're taught in school how to deal with these kinds of situations. And, you know, I could use a fork and a spoon in that hook to feed myself. That was what was great about all of it. Learning, let me restate that. It's not that it was great that this happened. It was just great that, I don't know how I'm going to get through, but I am. And that to me was a blessing.
Yeah, you're gaining back a little bit of independence with each new thing you learn.
Exactly. So I'm glad you stated that because, you know, at this point I lost my independence, so I'm regaining it. My right side took a little longer to heal. It took probably 6 to 8 months before I could be fitted. And so I was fitted on my right side with what they call myoelectric. And so how it operated was, so picture my arm on this stub, you would put this silicone sock and it was sort of tight. And at the very end of the silicone sock, it had a little pin and it was interesting how you put it on because you rolled it up and then you took a spray bottle we had alcohol bottles and we sprayed it on the silicone and it actually made the thing go on so smooth. And my prosthetist showed us that. That was really cool. The reason why I had to have that silicone sock is because this myoelectric, there were little sensors on my, what they call muscle bellies. Whenever you flex your hand or make a fist or move your hand a certain way, there's different muscle bellies that are moving. So what they do is they try to attach these sensors onto those muscle bellies so that when you do make those movements, so even though your hand is not there and you want to flex your wrist, you still are going to be able to move that muscle and it's going to open and close that prosthetic. So I was finally fitted and they finally got it right and everything, all the sensors working and everything. However, I didn't like it because it just felt like an extension. It just felt like a heavy weight. Say, for example, just take an umbrella and you hold it straight out and you hold your arm as straight as possible and you just hold it out in front of you. Well, eventually you're going to get tired. It's just going to, because you have nothing to support that at the end. So it causes you to get tired and weak. And that's how I felt with the right prosthetic. However, I'm still grateful at this point because I'm gaining this independence.
All right. I would think their response to you for that would be, yeah, I know it feels that way now, but you just got to work up to it. You'll get used to it. You know, were they telling you anything like that?
Oh yeah, they were. I took that. I took it, took that advice. It just, I found it more, I actually could do a lot more with my hook than I could with my electric hand.
You read an article about someone who got the first double hand transplant.
Yeah. So this is actually in the new year by then. There was a story about the first unilateral transplant in Pittsburgh. I was just fresh out of the army, so I still had friends texting me, and this one guy that I was friends with said, hey, did you see that person they just transplanted in Pittsburgh? So I looked at the story and I wasn't interested. A few months later, I remember seeing a magazine at the prosthetist office about ACA, Amputee Coalition of America. And in this magazine, talked about phantom pain, phantom sensation, talked about what it's like living with the amputation. And there was also an article in there of Dr. Lee was talking to this one patient about she had viral meningitis, lost both of her hands, and she was going through some issues. And then he just talked about, the article just talked about that, you know, she could be a potential candidate for transplants. So I saw that and I'm like, okay, I kept that in the back of my mind. And then around July of 2009, my parents had a People magazine sitting on the kitchen table. And I'm like, what's this about? And I see a picture on the front about, story says about this Air Force veteran just had double hand transplants, wants to be able to hold his grandchild, wants to be able to bake again, and wants to be able to throw softball. So I go to the story, read the story, and it was just very inspiring to me of all the things he wanted to do. At the end of that article, there was some information of who to contact. I reached out to the number, contacted them the next day. And at this point, I thought about it, and I kind of was already sold on it, even though I just read that article. And they didn't tell me anything. They didn't tell me if I was accepted or anything, but I'm like, I'm going to do this. I actually was thinking, what do I have to lose at this point? Because I had already been, it's already been 7 months since I've had not had hands. The next day, they tell me, oh, yeah, you know, I had to be around 40 years old, had to be healthy, had to be below the elbow amputee. I was actually both below the elbow. So they're like, oh, yeah, and then why don't you come out? So I went to Pittsburgh.
And that's convenient because this was Pittsburgh. So you weren't, how far away were you from there?
I live in Harrisburg, so it's about 3 hours.
I mean, it could have been that People magazine was talking about this guy that had surgery in California or something.
Right. And at the time after I read it, it was done in Pittsburgh. That is interesting. I never looked at it that way, but that's interesting. What was nice is my brother lives in Pittsburgh, so we stayed with him. I was there for 5 days, and each day I had different things I had to do. There was psychological tests. There was psychiatrists, talked to social workers, talked blood work.
And this is just to determine eligibility, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I went through this thing, and on the fifth day, I remember them doing pheresis. And what they do is they actually extract from you, because you're on this machine and it's actually hooked to you and it recirculates, and they keep these cells and they store them, deep freeze them, to, if you are a candidate and chosen, that if you're, you know, once you have the transplants and something happens, they can actually administer them back to you.
They were planning ahead. Yeah.
They were planning ahead, and they were pretty thorough. So the 5 days I went through all that. I also remember going to talk to the doctor, Dr. Lee, and some other doctors were in there, and they're like, yeah, you'd be a great candidate. And the DOD was funding this. So it was all research, and I wasn't really thinking of any of that, but I'm like, I'm going to do this. I had nothing to lose. So they said, you'd be a good candidate, but you have to wait until a year post amputation. By then, though, I was already 7 months in past my amputation. So I come back home and go on about my life. And I was excited telling everybody. And so that year, my children, I have twins, boy and girl, and they were going to turn 18. Going through all of that, getting out of the military, losing my job, you know, and calling all these insurances about all the different things about your traumatic loss and all that. Did all that. And then I said to my kids about, I was deployed to Germany in 2002. So I wanted to go back. And I said, what do you think about going to Germany for your 18th birthday? So I go to Germany with them right before my transplant. So I come home December of 2009, called, put my name on a list. 2 months to the day that I put my name on the list, they found a donor. So it had been February 3rd was the evening I was called.
What were the requirements for a match? I mean, it seems like obviously blood type and size, but what were they looking for?
Scott, there was so much. I still don't even really know the full answer. I just know that during all that blood work and I remember they drew 17 vials of blood out of me. And they were testing for viral strands. I remember that was a big thing. They were making sure that everything matches up somewhat, somehow. I don't know. Can't wrap my head around it to figure that out, but that's what they did. So they had to find somebody that was of almost the same size.
I tend to think of just like superficial things, like you're a white man. And if a donor that was a perfect match otherwise came up and it was the hands of a black man.
Right.
I mean, do you say no? I mean, it's better to have hands, even if they are going to look like they don't match your body, but maybe they don't even consider a match like that. I don't know.
I don't think that they would do that. I really don't. I don't know the answer, but.
No, probably not. I mean, there's got to be other ramifications for that too, psychologically, or I don't know. But I mean, obviously that's not what happened anyway. So you found out that you were a match, and what happened from that point?
I guess it's this phone call, around 11:30.
That's 11:30 at night.
11:30 at night. Yeah. What's strange is that living at my parents, they had a landline, and back then something had to be wrong if you were getting a phone call that late at night. So I decided to pick it up. And then that's whenever they said, we had found the match. We need you in Pittsburgh by 7 o'clock in the morning. This is 11:30 at night. So 8 hours. I remember getting off the phone. My mother and dad were asleep. I had to wake them up. We got in the car and we drove to Pittsburgh. We got there before 7, and they said, oh yeah, we're going to be doing your surgery in a couple hours. Well, something happened and it ended up being postponed until the 5th. Well, to set that scene, February 5th, in that time of the year, February, and in Pittsburgh, they get a lot of snow. And maybe you recall this, but they called it the snowpocalypse. So DC got shut down. It snowed that hard. One of the doctors that did my microsurgery was from UCLA. However, he was red-eye flighted to Pittsburgh during this snowstorm. And the reason he was is because he was part of the team prior to my surgery. I thought that was interesting because as soon as my surgery was over, he had to go back to UCLA. I do recall them having an anesthesiologist come in, and they, of course, put all their different connections to you to connections. Yeah. But that's the last I recall, because I think I was in and out of it by then because it was, you know, the medicine may have been kicking in or whatever. I recall the surgery being 11 and a half hours long. There was 21 surgeons and there was 4 operating tables. So they're preparing me on 2 tables. So there's a table on it under each arm. They're preparing that area. And then they're preparing the limbs off of the donor and another table. A little bit of what I know of the donor is that the man was from West Virginia, who's brain dead. And I know this because I could see it. He had red hair. I remember waking up the next morning and the doctor say, wiggle your fingers, but don't move them too much because, you know, everything's all the connections are new, all, you know, this with the sutures and so on and so forth.
You don't want to break them right away, right?
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. But I moved them. I was like, wow. And so I had that in my mind that, yo, I'm getting transplants. My hands are going to work right away. I was definitely put down by that because that's not how it worked.
Wow. But at least you had control of it. I mean, that was kind of, that's what the sign of success they were looking for, that you could move your fingers. What they did had worked.
Right. But I think in my mind, I was thinking they're going to, you know, I'm going to have full function, but I guess that was irrational to think that. So right after that surgery, of course, they usually try to get you ambulatory right away. So they put me, I was out for 11 and a half hours and the full medication, and they're trying to get me to walk just a little bit. And it felt like it was 10 miles that I'm walking, but it was only a short distance. And I started doing therapy. It's hand therapy. It's like to make sure that to lower the swelling and just different things that happen after surgery. So they were trying to prevent all of those such things.
Yeah. Your therapy schedule was crazy.
Yeah. In the beginning, it was 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. And they wanted to do, a lot of times they wanted to do more. They wanted to do on the weekends. And at that point, I look back and I'm thinking, wow, I can't do all this. I'm still looped up on the medication from surgery. And it seemed like it took for a couple of weeks for that to go out of my system. And then all the different medications. So before the transplants, they give you this medication that depletes your system of all immunity. So basically you're susceptible to anything afterwards, after this. So basically they're tearing you down, building you back up. After the surgery, I was in what they call TICU, traumatic intensive care unit. So I was in this TICU for 2 weeks, taken care of the whole time. Couldn't move my arms. I mean, I have them in these pillow type things made of foam to protect my arms. So I know we talked about independence. So I lost my independence again, but now I'm regaining this independence.
Imagine unlocking a version of yourself that's unstoppable, where mental barriers no longer hold you back. Listen to Mentally Stronger with me, Amy Morin, therapist and international best-selling author, here to guide you on a journey to reaching your greatest potential. Every Monday, I bring you into conversations with some of the most fascinating minds, experts, authors, entrepreneurs, athletes, and musicians. They don't just share stories. They reveal the mental strategies that propelled them to the top. But here's the real magic. At the end of each episode, I break down their wisdom into practical therapist-approved advice. In my solo episodes, I dive deep into the techniques that build mental strength. It's like having your own personal therapy session as you discover how to turn these insights into steps you can take right now. This podcast isn't just for those facing mental health challenges. It's for anyone who wants to push their limits, achieve peak performance, and truly thrive. Are you ready to unlock your full potential? Then it's time to become mentally stronger. Subscribe to Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, available wherever you love to listen to podcasts.
Hey. Do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out the Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for adults and kids alike. For years now, Sleepy has helped millions of people catch some much-needed Z's, start their next day off fresh, and discover old books that they didn't know they loved. So, whether you have a tough time snoozing or you just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune into Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes each week. Sweet dreams.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind, but there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We were talking about how long these occupational therapy appointments were. So they were 6 hours a day. And so I'm in Pittsburgh now, and I was there for 7 months. So from February to August. And during that time frame of going through all these therapy sessions. So my routine was I get up in the morning. I stayed at this place called Family House, and it was a nonprofit organization that allows people to stay there depending on what kind of thing they're having at UPMC. Because I was on this research program, they actually paid for my stay there. But I had to have a family member be with me because they had to prepare my meals. It was like an old hotel. So I would get up in the morning, my parents, well, whoever was staying me, people would stay a week at a time. One week it'd be my mother or my dad, whoever. I would go over to the hospital. First thing in the morning, I'd have to go for blood work. There was a lot of transplant patients because they did a lot of transplants in Pittsburgh, but they all had to have blood work because their doctors were, you know, trying to get this medication levels to make sure everything's going the way it's supposed to. And I would get so frustrated because sometimes it would take an hour or two. I would sit down there for an hour or two. So that whole time, and I'm kind of a go-getter. I got to be on the move. And then I was in the military, and it doesn't help to just sit around like what we called in the Army, hurry up and wait. That's one thing I can't stand is sitting and waiting around for what, you know, and it's like, can't we process this or speed it up? Eventually, as anything, is what I found out later, everything in life's temporary. So I would go to the blood work, it would be an hour late for therapy. And then by then I was thinking I was starting 8 to 2. That'll be my 6 hours. And then of course my doctors, they wanted to come in. They wanted to come in, see how I was doing. They wanted to do video and they want to do this and do that. And I actually got to the point where, how am I going to make this time up? You want me to do well and do my best, but then you're coming in and taking away from my time. And so basically what it would do is when they come in, if they were in there for an hour, then I'd have to stay another hour. I didn't want to do that. I wanted my 6 hours and I wanted to be done. I was just adamant about that. But again, it was temporary. Went through all that, you know, and those are just little growing pains I went through. Went through that. And during this therapy, I actually met the article I read in the People magazine. His name was Jeff Kepner. He had to come in, and I forget why he was there, but he had to do some therapy. And he was like, why are you working so hard? Like, I just want to get done. I want to go home. That's one thing about me, Scott, is I'm a worker. I will stay at something until I am done. It doesn't matter what it is. I'll work on it. I'm determined to get it done. And that was what I was determined. So I went through the therapy and that guy telling me that. And backstory is I'm doing much better than he is. Hindsight is that therapy paid off. Finally, it came to time. I got to come back home. Going through all those growing pains in Pittsburgh, that 7 months, I was told that I'd come back and go to Hershey. And I actually got to go back to the hand therapist that fitted me for my prosthetics. All in all, I was there. I went to therapy for 5 years.
What can you do now with your new hands that you couldn't do when you first got them?
Well, I always start off with this, and that's a good question. People will ask me that. What can you do? It's not what can I do. It's how can I do it? I know that I have limited dexterity. I was a mechanic prior to losing my hands. I still have the mindset to be a mechanic, but I just can't do I just don't have the dexterity to do that type of work. Again, determined is a word that doesn't leave me. I am determined to do it. I actually work on my own stuff at home. I have small engines like blowers and weed eaters and slammers, and I do, you know, that kind of mechanic work on that stuff. It's basically, I'm not under the gun to say, oh, well, you need to get this job done faster. No one's pressuring me to do that. I can honestly say the only thing I can't do or haven't tried, I've not fired a weapon, because now that I'm left-handed, you have to hold the weapon differently than you do when you're right-handed. And the other thing is I don't have the strength. I mean, even though pulling the trigger may not seem like a lot, I don't have enough strength in my fingers to do it.
So you can move all your fingers. You just don't have the same grip strength as with your original hands.
No. A man can have anywhere from 80 to 100 pounds of strength in his hand. You're like, that's a lot. I think the most I've ever had was 20. That's probably a good comparison of what I had and what I have now. But you know what? I don't discount any of it.
Yeah, that's the way to look at it. Because, I mean, yeah, comparing it to a person that never lost their hands, yeah, you're a lot less. But comparing it to what you had when you were standing there in the field, stuck in the machine, you're miles ahead of that.
Yeah, and then I can also say, I know this is a traumatic story, and we're talking about it, and what was it like kind of thing, and I'm telling all ins and outs. But, you know, there's other stories out there that I have no idea what it would be like, because I'm not in those shoes. So I can relate, I can understand what's going on, but I've never lived it. So it shows me to be more compassionate. I can say that, to respect what I have.
Because we don't know what other people have gone through.
Right.
Let me ask you one final question. Why is it important for you, for people to hear your story? What's the message you want to get out there?
It is an inspiring thing, an inspiring situation for people to hear, because I know everybody in life has troubles. I don't care who you are. Sometimes telling your story, you may tell it to somebody that you don't even know what's going on, and it can make their day much better whenever they see it and see what they've gone through. And I have a quick story about my wife. My wife and I met online, but it was not a dating site. And I posted my story about losing my hands and how thankful I was. And her story was she was going through a divorce and how hard it was for her. But then she's like, read my story, and she's like, wow, this man, I cannot believe how thankful he is and everything he's been through. My story is not that bad. And that's what the point I'm trying to make is that, yeah, you can't discount anybody's story, but you can also enlighten somebody's day by hearing the story. And that's what I felt that happened between my wife and I. And we just, you know, an ending note is, we've been married now a month. We've been dating each other since 2011. I actually met her for the first time one year anniversary of my hand transplant.
So you just got married?
Yes, I just got married. And
congratulations. I didn't even know that.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I just got married. We're living here in Pennsylvania, and things are all good. I'm blessed, thankful.
Life is good.
Yes.
If someone is hearing this and is going through something, maybe not losing their hands, but something traumatic, or might be discouraged or whatever, and would like to contact you, you've said that it's okay. We'll put your email address in the show notes so people can contact you if they would like to.
Sure.
Chris, thanks so much for sharing your story.
Ah, you're welcome, Scott. My pleasure.
The thing that struck me about this story is the outlook that Chris had right from the start. Okay, this thing happened to me. I can't go back and change what happened, but I can be determined to do the best I can with what I have. I really hope that if I ever have something like this happen to me, that I would have the same outlook. You can get the full transcript for this episode, and you can also see pictures of Chris and what he can do with his new hands in the episode notes at whatwasthatlike.com/146. I did another episode that was kind of similar to this one, where my guest Jeff talks about losing his arm while he was working at a summer job when he was 18 years old.
While that was happening, I'm pulling, trying to get myself out, but at this point the machine actually started to pick me up off the ground, and I was starting to be pulled in head first. And so at that point, I started screaming, one, because it hurt, and two, because I wanted somebody to come turn the machine off, because I knew that I wasn't going to be able to get myself out.
And believe it or not, that episode will have you laughing, because Jeff has a great sense of humor, and there are definitely some funny parts to his story. That's episode number 100, called Jeff's Arm Was Torn Off. And now I am super excited to tell you about a new project, and it's one that you can be involved in. This is a great opportunity to seriously make someone's day. We all know that working in the service industry is a tough job. More specifically, I'm talking about food service. The hourly pay is really low, sometimes way less than minimum wage, so food servers have to rely on tips to make a living. These people work really hard, and they have to keep smiling no matter what's happening during their shift. So I want to make at least one person's shift very happy. This is where you come in. And you can participate in this at whatwasthatlike.com/server. I'm asking you to kick in a dollar or two or whatever you feel like contributing. When it gets up to a substantial amount, I'm going to take that money and present it to a food server as a gift. This is going to be so cool to be able to tip someone like $500, maybe even more than that. I honestly really don't know what to expect. I posted about this project in the podcast Facebook group recently, and the vast majority of people there are excited about this idea too. And just to be clear, I'm not taking anything out of this. This is being done through GoFundMe, so everyone can see their donation and everyone knows what the total amount is. GoFundMe will take out their fee, but everything else is going to go directly to someone who works hard and needs that money. So I invite you to join us in this fun little project. Go over to whatwasthatlike.com/server and put in whatever amount you're comfortable with. And I'll have further updates here on the podcast and also in the Facebook group. If you're not in that group yet, that's at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. I can't wait to see what happens with this. Graphics for this episode were created by Bob Bretz. Full episode transcription was created by James Lai. And now, once again, we find ourselves at this week's listener story. This is a story sent in by a listener. And since you're a listener, you could send in your story. Just something interesting, 5 to 10 minutes long, nothing elaborate. You can record it on your phone and email it to me at scott@whatwasthatlike.com. And there's a pretty good chance we'll all hear it on a future episode. This week's listener story is from Cecilia, who was on drugs without knowing about it. Stay safe, and I'll see you back here in 2 weeks.
Hi, Scott. My name is Cecilia, and I love your podcast. And I just wanted to share this story because every time I tell friends or anything like that, it always gets a good reaction. So I thought maybe you or the listeners might enjoy. And I will preface it with saying it may be triggering to some people who have had bad experience with being drugged or drugs in general. And I also want to say I was in an incredibly safe situation. My life was never in danger. I was with my family the whole time, and everything was totally fine. This is the story of the time I got drugged with meth. So I was with my family out of town and at a very Christian wedding of a family friend of ours. My family didn't grow up super religious. You know, we went to church every once in a while, but it was never very serious. And this was a very traditional, very devoted Christian wedding, I'll say. Like, their first kiss was their I do kiss, and everyone there was very straight-laced for the most part. They didn't have any hard alcohol, just wine and beer. And yeah, pretty much everyone was quite straight-laced aside from our table of family friends and stuff that were a little bit, I wouldn't say we're crazy or anything, but there was a group of us that was more delinquent than the rest. So some of my friends or family friends brought in little shooters of hard alcohol. And we were definitely the odd man out there of the very Christian environment that we were in. And so from my perspective, I remember the first set of the band and nothing really after that. I have 3 flashes of memory. One is me looking at myself in the bathroom thinking, I only drank wine. Like, how did I get this drunk? I didn't drink that much wine. The second one is me running around as fast as I can trying to pick up all the bouquets of flowers from the table after the band had stopped to help clean up when everybody was leaving. I don't know why I was doing that. And the last one is me in bed in a ball, naked, crying with my sisters trying to make me put clothes on. And so from my family's perspective, the band played 3 sets. And after about the first set, I start going crazy on the dance floor. And you all don't know me, but I'm pretty reserved and I'm shy. I'm not a big dancer. I don't really... You know, I'm kind of in the background. I'm pretty shy. And so they saw me on the dance floor with my fist pumping and my jaw clenched and looking like I must have been having fun, but looking like a crazy person. And they were like, what is up with Cecilia? Like, we have never seen her like this before. And my stepmom almost immediately was like, she's on drugs. Like, she's definitely on drugs. That's not normal. And so they kind of honed in their focus on me. We got through the night and got back to our Airbnb at the time. And they were asking me, what did you take? What did you do? I was like, I didn't do anything. I'm just drunk. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I just drank wine. And eventually I started crying because they were asking me a lot of questions. And, you know, I was on meth. So was a little emotional. And I wouldn't stop crying until my sister threw pizza on the ground. And that made me laugh for a second. And then I started crying again. And I didn't know why I was crying. And it was very emotional. And I got through the night. My family, you know, clothed me and wiped away my tears and did as best as they could. And then I got back to New York where I was living at the time. And I took a drug test when I got back. And I had methamphetamine and MDMA in my system. So my best guess is that somebody else had Molly water in their wine or some sort of liquid Molly in their wine or something. And I actually drank someone else's wine and I ended up being cut with meth. I don't know. I don't know how I got meth in my system. But anyways, weeks go by and then I see the couple post their wedding photos on a Facebook album. And I was like, oh gosh. So I look through the Facebook album and there I am, lo and behold, on meth in the background of all these wedding photos. I look absolutely ridiculous. I'm like jaw clenched, eyebrows furrowed, like arms up, looking like a person on meth. You would imagine they would look. So yeah, that's how I ended up being on meth in the probably one of the last places you want to accidentally be on meth at. And yeah, I tried meth just once and I don't think I'll ever do it again. Not on purpose, at least. Thanks for listening. I love your podcast. Keep doing what you're doing.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking try free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.